This is exactly right.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
On the 12th season of Tenfold More Wicked, we investigate a series of compelling mysteries from the city of Fall River, Massachusetts, where problems started generations before Lizzie Borden's murders made her a household name. Join me as we cover the misfortunes that have befallen this infamous town for more than 150 years, including the Great Fire of 1843. Season 12 premieres Monday, May 13th on Exactly Right. Follow Tenfold More Wicked on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to My Favorite Murder,
the podcast where you ask the questions and we don't have the answers.
And why would we?
Like, we're not answer people.
We, you know that. We've said it a million times. And also, get your own fucking answers. Whoops.
And then give them to us, please. Email them to myfavoritemurder@gmail.com.
Don't forget to Instagram some answers. Yeah. Take a picture of the answers and send them to George on Instagram.
You guys are so smart. Mm-hmm. You really are.
You absolutely are.
This is a teaching podcast. We teach you how smart you are. By not having answers and requesting them. Maybe we do have answers and we're not really telling you because we want you to learn them yourself.
I mean, it does invite the listener in to participate. Hey, we're going to tell you this story. Are we wrong? Let us know.
That's this thing where when I was a kid, and this fucking pissed me off more than anything, when I'd ask my mom how to spell something and she'd say, look it up.
Look it up.
We have a whole set of dictionaries or whatever the fuck. Fuck you. Just spell this three-letter word
but
for me.
You know what that was? What? She didn't know how to spell it. Hello. It's a classic mom trick.
Mom, you asshole.
Pretend to be teaching because you don't know. That's like my dad going, me complaining about I can't do math. Him going, well, just tell me what the problem is. Me being like, no, I don't want to open this door. 3 hours later, my dad's screaming about new math. Screaming, like
sorry,
trying to read the book
anymore.
Yeah, from the beginning. He's going to help me.
Let me look at the beginning of this chapter.
Hold on. Let me just read this.
No.
Forget it. And also, it's helped me in no way.
Yeah.
In life.
Math?
No math has helped me.
No. Basic algebra. All you need.
And even then, really, what are these concepts? It's almost like in algebra, they're trying to get you. It's like, I don't have to, like, plan the projection of a rocket ship to get from here to Mars. It's never going to happen in my life.
Unless you're a rocket person.
Yep. Scientist, they call sometimes.
A rocket businessman, I think they call them. Or woman. I'm not going to be. Or a mathematician.
A rocket businessman.
Woman. Like, let's not. I'm sorry.
Please.
Edit that out.
Person.
Person. It could be any gender fluid.
You could
be a man or
sell
woman.
Rocket ships. You could ride on rocket ships and just be the accountant on the rocket ship.
There's got to be someone who sells parts.
Where's that guy in the Alien series? Where is the rocket ship accountant that gets eaten first?
Oh,
I wonder if that's Paul Reiser was the irritating guy in at least one of the Alien series.
Yeah. But was he the one who got his stomach busted open?
No. Although something bad did happen to him. I shouldn't say no because,
well, everyone
but
died.
I think I know the one you're thinking of, yeah. Which is the one where they all had to witness it.
Man, I need to rewatch that movie.
It's the best movie.
That and Spaceballs I haven't seen in too long.
Very similar.
Right?
Similar films. It's
the same kind of idea.
I'm thinking of Aliens 2 though, right? Paul Reiser's and Steven, Aliens 2.
We're getting
2.
A yes from young Steven who knows
yes.
Shit.
Science Steven.
Those are some of my favorite movies. And yeah, Paul Reiser, you know, he has to get it in the end. Spoilers.
Yes. Because he's the douchebag.
Yeah.
Oh. He's the corporate douchebag that's like, hey, we got to do this. So, you know, hey, I'm going to get you to do something.
Yeah, he's in charge.
Yeah.
Can I say Sigourney Weaver from the first Aliens is my underwear muse?
Oh, hell yes.
Those cotton, high-waisted underwear that are a little loose, yeah. or the sexiest thing. Like that's, I stopped wearing G-strings when I fucking saw that as an adult.
I have to tell you, those underwear are only sexy if you have really long legs.
Oh.
If you don't, you look like someone's grandma.
You do.
Which is a genre for some people.
Sure.
I don't want to kink shame anybody, God forbid. But you really need to have the pegs to make those grandma underwear work.
Amen. And I don't. So
also you can't have, if it was a realistic movie
yeah.
of her working on a spaceship and being all like bedraggled by being chased by aliens, mm-hmm. she would have had like some razor burn.
Full bush.
She would have had bush coming out of those underwear. She's not waxing up in space.
Listen, I'm a feminist. Do whatever you want with your bush.
Listen.
I don't want to see it.
Right. I mean, that's not your specific thing.
No, that's not my kink.
That's not your kink. Perhaps it's someone else's. Everybody's included and everybody's supported.
This is a murder podcast.
Guys, are you here for true crime? Well, that's great.
Is this your first time listening? You
so
are not
sorry.
At the wrong place.
Don't leave.
Don't go. We're about to talk about murder.
Don't go.
Don't leave us. I have a specifically gruesome one today.
Do you really?
It's not gruesome. It's just that I've been working on it. Anyways, I have to shout out a couple things. This will be quick, everyone.
Okay.
Someone named Julia H-U-R, made a fucking 8-bit video game of my favorite murder.
That's right.
And it is, I almost started crying when I saw it. Vince was playing it. You have
Steven
to,
loves it.
In the beginning, you fight doctors and nurses, evil doctors and nurses that are trying to kill you. It's you and me and Elvis. And the way we kill people is Elvis attacks them. And then you have to go to the Cecil Hotel. You can take elevators up to kill certain like different kinds of killers.
Amazing.
This like 8-bit music. It's all 8-bit, but it's like incredible. And so you go, okay, this is a weird, Julia, we need you to fix this website. It's JUKEL.ITCH.IO. I'm sorry if I actually have sent you to a,
Some kind of
virus
underpants kink site.
Right. But I don't think it is. You can go play this video game. I don't know what she's going to do with it, but she needs to conquer the world with it.
That's amazing.
It's so good.
Now, I have to tell you, sadly, I am so old. I am from I predate 8-bit video games. So like, I know that that's the 90s kids. It's a big deal to them because they played them and it's the whole like, Oregon Trail style shit.
Oh yeah, I played that.
I'm older than that. I'm older than
that. So you guys didn't have computer labs in your elementary school?
Well, we didn't have them anyway because it was Catholic school, which is super cheap.
Right, our
scrap paper, we used paper that was the old menus from restaurants in town.
Are you fucking kidding me?
I swear to God.
That kind of sounds cool because I love menus.
Well, it was fun. And my friend Ken Mason, one of my first friends, because I went there in sixth grade, so I was new. Mm. He was also new and he turned to me and goes, "Ma'am, may I take your order this morning?" And I was like, "Hi, new best friends." Hi, best person
That's
ever.
Incredible.
Yeah. But I was going to say, I think I've told you this already, our version of computer lab, quote unquote, mm-hmm. was they taught us basically how to enter code where they're like, they basically we were working for the school where they're like, enter this on this line and this on this line. And we were just doing.
They're like having you do their books.
Yeah. It was like data entry where they're like, put in 01, 01, 01, 01 all the way across.
Child labor.
Yeah. It was ridiculous. We had no idea what it was, how it applied to computers.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It's like that. Not necessary unless you're a rocket businessman.
Computers and math are extraneous bullshit that you don't need to be taught.
Listen, I know email.
Look.
I know some things. I know how to blog.
No, a couple things.
I can write about myself for hours.
Should I mention, first we should say thank you so much. We went to Detroit and Toronto last weekend.
Fucking nicest crowds.
Incredible crowds. Incredible shows. We had the best time.
Yeah.
I didn't tweet anything about it because on my way home, I was like, oh no, it's too late. I didn't want to do do everybody at once, but they were such good shows. And at the Toronto show, this was my favorite part. And when I told my sister, she started crying. There was a woman, people who were holding up signs in the audience. It was really funny. But of course, I had my glasses on, so I just saw that there were like,
I need to remember
squares.
That and point shit out to you.
Yeah.
Because like, I think that you're not pointing it out because you don't want to, but like, remember when the two girls dressed as the Shining twins in the front row?
Yes.
Like, if I hadn't fucking pointed that out to you, I would have cried.
I was like, that's embarrassing. Those two girls wore the same outfit.
And they're sitting next to each other.
But there was a girl, I told my sister the story. There was a girl that we met afterwards who was holding up a sign that said MFM saves lives.
Yeah.
And when I told my sister, she burst into tears. Aww. Where I'm just like, but the best part about it was, so that's a brag.
Tell a brag.
As we do. But when we met her, at the meet and greet afterwards, and she goes, I thought everyone was going to have a sign. And I was like, this isn't a march. You're at a live show. And she for some reason had it in her head that everybody was going to have a sign to hold up at the show. She was so nice. It was the cutest thing in the world. It was really fun.
It was
fun.
A big, and I remember walking out and seeing it. It was a really big sign. And I was like, oh, the people behind her are so pissed. That's like all I could think, not like, oh my God, how nice. I was like, oh fuck. No, it was really sweet. And
it was hilarious.
It was great. And God, we're just so fucking lucky.
We're so lucky.
These the best people.
I know. It's so fun. So thank you, Detroit. Thank you, Toronto. Yeah. Thank you, JFL, for inviting us. We had a great time and we were really honored to close the festival. Yeah. They told us
totally. Speaking of live shows, really quickly, I just want to mention shows that are kind of new to the roster.
And still have tickets available.
So Fort Lauderdale on November 5th. Minneapolis on October 18th. In Kansas City, we added a late show, and that's on December 9th. The end.
Okay, great. If you're in any of those cities and you want to come and see us, there are tickets available.
Go get them. That's exciting. And then we're doing the LA in Los Angeles. We haven't announced, it's not like, we haven't been pushing this as much because it's not a huge show, but it's the LA Podcast Festival, which is our first show we ever did last year.
Yes.
And it was so much fun and we didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah. It was very close to our hearts. It is very close to our hearts because it's the first time we ever put this as a live. We didn't know at that show if people would even be okay with what we were doing
or
live.
Or come.
Yes. Or anything.
So, and The Dollop puts it on, who of course are our brother podcast, I feel like.
Yeah. And well, it's Dave Anthony. Yeah. It's Graham Elwood. It's Chris Mancini.
Right. Sorry. Yeah.
That's okay. Well, just so everybody gets credit.
Yeah.
So we don't want them fighting. We don't want those boys fighting.
No. So I think we're just going to do like little LA murders and then just bring people up to do hometowns. Maybe some of our comedy friends that there's a live show who are doing the show as well at the Pop Fest. And there's a ton of other really great podcasts to watch as well. So
there's so many good ones
this
year.
Pass.
Yeah.
Like great ones.
And it's at the Biltmore Hotel, yeah, which in and of itself is an amazing place to be in downtown Los Angeles.
Totally.
Gorgeous hotel.
Listen, get a hotel room at the Ace.
Listen.
Have a weekend. Go to Kohl's and get yourself a French dip.
You could, that's right, or Philippe's. Depends on which one.
Try them both and tell us which one you like better.
I like Philippe's better. You could get married and then stay at the Biltmore for the weekend and then come to PodFest. I think that could be fun.
Get married?
Yeah.
Can we marry people? We should get ordained.
That's a great idea.
Thank you.
The Church of... Thank you. I've been waiting for you to say that. The Church of... what's that? There's an internet church.
Satan.
Well, yeah, we could do that.
I mean, why not?
Well, I don't want to make my Aunt Mary mad. My Aunt Mary had knee surgery. She came through just fine.
Dottie got fixed today. She came through
very
just fine.
Very similar.
We were having... this is called...
One can talk and is my relative and is a human being. Just really
sorry,
quick.
I didn't mean to.
It's okay.
I didn't mean to belittle Aunt Mary.
I just wanted to put it out there that I'm happy that she made it through. She listens to this podcast.
That was very disrespectful of
it's
me.
It's okay. I know
apologize.
You didn't mean it that way.
I didn't.
You were just word associating.
Yeah, but also, you know, how much cats mean to me.
Of course. But and it's your own cat, which is, Stephen is having a nervous breakdown.
Right, right now. Stephen, what's so funny about
Stephen,
that?
What's going on?
No, I just like, I mean, you were just like, and Donnie.
I thought we were shouting out hospital people. I thought this
we
was
were.
A hospital corner.
We were.
I overstepped my bounds.
I needed to cap it. That's all.
No, it was perfect.
You got it.
It was perfect. That's just so like me.
Right.
And my cat.
It's your...
I can relate everything to my
style.
Cat.
Yeah. But Dottie came through fine.
It's okay. We don't have to do that.
I didn't mean to.
I know. No, she's fine. That'll be my thing I love at the end. Let's save that for the end. Cut that out.
Okay, good.
Don't cut that out. Okay. I think that's it.
Oh, my thing is there's something else I want to talk about. I can't remember what it is offhand, which is just
fun.
The style
it's
that
fun.
I'm in right now. But I will say this. I was going insane trying to enter Mindhunters, the new David Fincher series, into my DVR. I was doing it. I'm like, every time I would do it, it wouldn't accept it. I'm like, what the fuck? I'm too late. I'm too early. I'm too early.
Yeah,
I'm too
yeah.
early. Well, now I know for a fact it's starting, I believe, on October 13th.
I cannot wait.
Finally, I put it together. I had to look it up online. It's a Netflix series. There's nothing to program in my DVR. It was making means because I'm like, I'm going to miss it. And So anyone else who might be having that experience, it's a Netflix series that you can't pre-plan.
It's going to be so good. We're going to talk about it. We're going to have an extra mini-sode just to talk about
it. Yes, please.
We'll watch it together.
Yes. And then have a whole talk down. Because it's distracting me. There's lots of people that I love sending me suggestions constantly. And you. Yeah. On Twitter. Thank of, you. Have you seen this? Have you seen that?
I kind of demand. I felt bad the other night when I was like, watch this thing. You have to. And then I was like, texted back, I'm sorry, you don't have to
you
do
don't
anything.
Have to. We're very careful. Oh my God. We're trying to be very careful.
Very careful with each other's triggers.
Our That's
therapist
right.
said we're perfect together because we're the exact triggers for each other.
Yes.
We which are. Which I love.
It's
I think we're each other's sisters.
Yes.
Personalities.
Yes.
You're my sister and I'm your sister.
You're not my sister.
I'm not.
But
she's too fucking cool for me.
No, no.
I love her.
She is the greatest.
Yeah.
It's almost like everything that I've ever worried about myself. I see in you and then I get mad at
yeah.
you that I was like that.
Yeah.
It's like that crazy.
And I get scared of, I always make friends with these women who have big personalities and I get uh-huh. intimidated and I get intimidated easily and I don't act like myself, which they see and isn't fun. And then I change and get controlling and shit and weird.
Yeah. Because it makes sense to me though, when you have, cause I also make friends with people with big personalities
yeah.
and you're
That's
option,
a compliment. I fucking love badass women.
Yeah.
And I want to be friends with them.
But you have to also have boundaries
yeah.
and you have to be able to hold your own shit and like know, like I have a big personality, but I also absolutely want to know what you want. Like it's hard to manage that
yeah.
sometimes because I come from a family of screaming Irish people
and
that
I'm
are like
terrified of screaming people.
Shut the door. That's standard talking. That's
and I'm
normal
like,
talking.
She hates me. What did I do? I need to fix this. I'm going to be really nice to her. And then you're just like, she's annoying the shit out
then
of
I'm
me.
I'm like, what's that tone in her voice?
Yeah.
I think she might be snapping.
Yeah.
It's,
we're great.
Guys, we're working.
Look at us. Therapy is my God. Can you imagine life without therapy?
It would be bad.
I go to 3 therapists a week and I'm still not fixed.
I go to 2. We'll never be fixed.
No.
There's no fixing. We're not cats. It's just, right? You're just always working on it. It's just our project.
You guys,
and we have this project
be
together.
Honest. The best thing when we, after the shows, when we meet people is when they say, I went to therapy because you guys were so open about it. To me, that's like, therapy is my fucking so important, my jam. And like, if we can do that, then I don't give a shit anything else.
Exactly. It's such a weird side effect that we had no idea
yeah.
was going to happen.
Yeah.
And people have told on all of those shows,
yeah.
we had people at those meet and greets saying, I went back or I went for the first
yeah.
time or whatever it is. We're so grateful.
There was one girl who was like, my therapist made me come tonight.
Yes, that's right.
Remember?
Yeah.
She came alone. She was like, my therapist told me I have to come.
Yeah.
So cute. All right.
Then we get obsessed with like, did you meet those girls over there?
Yeah.
They're really nice. Like we want a friend match.
Yeah. I love it.
Anyhow, David Fincher, Netflix, Mindhunters. I cannot wait. It's based on early FBI serial killing profiling and how serial killers, like, it's just about all that.
It's everything we love.
And Finch
is with so good.
Beautiful shots of like a 70s
he did
green
Zodiac, right?
Nova. Yes, pulling
so
into a
Zodiac
shot.
And how gorgeous it was. This is gonna be a Netflix thing.
Yeah,
it's gonna
be a weekly series of beautiful shots.
Fuck. I'm so excited. Okay, anything else?
I think whatever else there is that is dominating my mind,
the Fincher thing.
Yeah.
Okay,
there's
I'm
nothing
just
else.
Obsessed. I don't have anything. March things, whatever.
Yeah, things are on sale. Buy shirt. You guys buy so many shirts.
Steven,
and things.
Shirts are going like hotcakes.
Oh, people loving those shirts.
People love this. They're starting to post photos of them. They're starting to get them. The Steven
nice
shirts are amazing. Who goes first this week? Me?
Yeah, if we're going by Toronto.
I don't even know what we go by anymore, but I'll
no,
take
that's
it.
What we go by.
Okay.
Just the shows we
whoever
do.
Went.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Cool.
We do it by our own personal calendar.
It's like the Jewish calendar, mm-hmm. but it's My Favorite Murder calendar.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
We're as old as the Jewish calendar.
We really are.
And historic.
Hey, Karen, you know that feeling when you're stressed out and your heart starts to pound and your mind is racing?
I do. I know it well.
Well, while there's no cure for stress, therapy can help shape your response to it. And since May is Mental Health Awareness Month, there's no better time to try Talkspace.
When you sign up for Talkspace, you'll receive a personalized match with a therapist or psychologist, typically within 48 hours.
Forbes rates Talkspace as the number one online therapy platform, plus their licensed professionals are in-network with almost all major insurance companies.
Once you meet your therapy goals, or if you want to cancel for any reason, Talkspace will provide you with a prorated refund for unused time. I feel like these days people understand the importance of therapy, but the difficult part is just taking that first step. It took me months to make my first therapy appointment. I was so scared. I had a lot of ideas in my head about it. And that's why I think Talkspace is such a good idea, because making it so approachable will just get you there sooner. Then you can actually get in there, figure out what you need, talk to an actual professional, and be on your way to solving some stuff that you might want to solve.
To celebrate Mental Health Awareness Month and the power of talking it out in therapy, Talkspace is offering our listeners $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80.
Go to Talkspace.com/MFM and use promo code SPACE80.
To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/MFM and enter promo code SPACE80 and get $80 off your first month and show your support for our show.
That's Talkspace.com/MFM. Enter promo code SPACE80.
Goodbye.
There's something about the sound of an old-timey cash register that really takes me back.
I know. It sounds like someone is about to hand me an ice cream cone, but it also sounds like we just sold some merch.
That's right. And if you're a Shopify user like us, you know that this sound means you just made a sale.
Shopify has helped millions of businesses sell their products online, but did you know they also offer the same support for brick and mortar stores?
From accepting payments to managing inventory, they have everything you need to sell in person. So give your point of sale system a serious upgrade with Shopify.
Shopify POS tracks sales across all your locations. That way, you'll always know what you have in stock and where.
They also provide reliable tech that fits your unique retail needs, like turning a tablet into a credit card reader.
And if you're looking to reach new customers, check out Shopify's marketing tools. They're easy to use and they integrate with all social media platforms.
With Shopify, we have a powerful partner for managing our sales. And if you're a business owner, you can too.
Do retail right with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period today at shopify.com/murder. And here's the important note, that promo code is all lowercase.
So go to shopify.com/murder and take your retail business to the next level.
That's shopify.com/murder. Again, don't forget, the code is all lowercase.
Goodbye.
Are you ready for Dean Corll, the Candyman?
Oh.
I went there.
You went there?
I went there.
Shit.
I went there. Big shout out right now to the Texas Monthly article, The Lost Boys by Skip Hollingsworth, who I feel like we reference a lot. He writes incredible murder articles.
Skip Hollingsworth?
Hollingsworth.
Awesome.
It's called The Lost Boys. It's got a lot.
I feel like he wrote one that I did that was from Texas.
He's been on the show before.
Okay, that's awesome.
And then also, I want to shout out Marcus Parks from
Hell Yes,
fucking Last Podcast on the Left, for all the research. They did like a 4-part episode.
Yes.
That's like got a lot of details that this doesn't have. It's because I'm not going to do 4 parts of this.
No. It's so, their version of it was such a deep dive, but also so upsetting. There were things in that like I'd seen that story before on like whatever Forensic Files types of things.
It's really, he went into a deep dive of all these books. There's not a lot of documentaries. There's just some like videos on YouTube and shit, but there's not a lot of stuff.
This is an epic one. Okay.
It's amazing.
Wait.
All right.
I love it. And just, we love you, Marcus Parks.
Yeah. Thank you, Marcus Parks. You're a genius.
Okay. You're a mastermind.
You're, he's a murder savant.
He's just so good at researching.
He is.
I wish.
Okay.
Just give us all your old notes, Marcus.
Yeah.
It's like he's our brother and he already took the class.
Yeah. I'm like, can I copy?
Please just give it to us and we'll read your thing.
Yeah. And then we'll do our own, I swear.
We'll do a boring version of your podcast.
We promise. We're not going to have
Henry
Zabrowski talking in the background. So it's not going to be the same.
It'll be the quiet girl version.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. This is the Candyman, Dean Corll.
Ugh.
All right. On the evening of August 7th, it's 1973, Wayne Henley, he's a 17-year-old wiry kid, acne, thick brown hair. He's kind of like, looks like a Brooklyn hipster. He invites his 19-year-old friend, Timothy Curley, to a party at his friend Dean Coral's house in Pasadena, Texas. It's a suburb of Houston. And they bring along Henley's 15-year-old friend, Rhonda Williams. She had been beaten by her drunk father that night. Ugh. And so he was like, he took her out of the home for the time being. I was like, you can crash at my friend Dean Coral's house. Dean Coral is 33, and Henley tells them he's a chill dude. He lets people crash at his house and parties with them. 33-year-old guy who wants to party with teenagers?
Yep.
A red flag.
7 red flags.
100. What? I started singing a lot on this podcast.
You got to.
I know. Sometimes that's the only way to get real crazy shit out. Okay. They get there around 3 a.m. They drink. They smoke. They sniff paint. They pass the fuck out.
What? Sorry.
You know, it's the 70s. You sniff paint.
God, it's so... That is the bleakest, like... It's that thing of, like, when you scrape your pot pipes and you're just trying to get, like... You smoke old resin or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, sniffing paint is, like... 10 steps below that.
Well, because I bet the 70s weed is fucking terrible.
Sure.
And they're fucking high school kids. Have you seen, there's an amazing mugshot of a guy and it just has a ring of a paint can outline around his face.
It's gold, isn't it?
Gold paint ring. I used to have this tumbler. I had 100 tumblers and I had one called, it was called Look at This Fucking Convict. And I would post a photo of a mugshot and just write what happened. I should do that again.
That's funny.
Whatever. And I posted that one once. Okay. Okay. So, they pass out and Henley wakes up to find his mouth taped shut. His ankles are bound and Dean Coral is snapping handcuffs onto his wrist.
Fuck.
And Curly and Rhonda are also bound, gagged beside him. And Curly had been stripped naked. So when Henley woke up, Coral removes the gag and he says, I'll help you kill them if you just let me go.
Oh.
And he says, okay. So they untie Henley. They go to, Coral's going to, sexually assault Curly. And he says to, Henley, go assault Rhonda, and, ties them up. So Coral starts to assault Curly, and then Henley grabs Coral's pistol off the mantle, off the thing, and shouts, you've gone too far, Dean. I can't go on any longer. I can't have you kill all my friends. And shoots Dean Coral in the forehead, which didn't penetrate his fucking head.
What? This again? So,
I know. Why does this keep happening?
That's the second story we've heard where a bullet ricochets off of someone's skull.
Yep. Makes me feel a little better.
I mean, it's insanity.
Yeah.
It also makes me think, is it the killers? Like, is this a trait of certain types of people?
When people say, you got a real thick skull.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a thing.
Yeah.
Science people.
Guys.
Figure it out.
Science people.
Cure cancer, then figure it out.
Yeah. Don't prioritize this, please.
So he shoots Dean 5 more times in the hallway. He finally collapses dead. There's a fucking photo of that.
Of course
online,
there is.
But you can't see his face. And this murder of Dean Coral ends the worst serial killer case in Houston history.
Oof.
Wayne Henley calls the police on himself. They arrive and Henley explained what had happened that night. And the police thought of him as a hero initially because he saved his friends. And then the story took a turn as Henley began to tell detectives the crazy story of the past 3 fucking years.
Ooh.
So ever since they met in 1971, under the command of Dean Coral, Henley had helped procure teenage boys, some of whom had been his own friends, for Dean Coral to rape and murder.
Ugh.
The detectives were like, fuck you, that's not true. They were totally skeptical. But they went through the crime scene with the house of Dean Coral, and they started finding things that were like, oh shit, maybe he's not lying. They found plastic sheeting covering the floors, a plywood board with handcuffs on each corner, which you can see online as well, dildos and other torture devices. And then also his Ford Econoline had a wooden crate with air holes drilled in the sides, pegboard walls, and in the rear of the van were rigged with several rings and hooks.
Ooh.
This part of the fucking story in last podcast on the left, the shit that Henry Zebrowski's saying is some of the funniest shit I've ever heard.
Yes.
It's like epic.
He's the master.
Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of triggering shit in there, but that part's great. Okay. Da-da-da-da-da. And inside the crate were several strands of human hair. They're still skeptical, though. And so Henley's like, let me show you something. He leads detectives to a Southwest Houston boat shed rented by Coral, gives the names of three boys they could find buried in there that had been reported. And the cops were like, well, those boys had been reported missing for 3 years. And so they start to dig.
This is the part in Last Podcast on the Left where it's so upsetting and fucked up. I think even Henry was upset at this part because it's so disturbing.
Well, there's this document. The only good documentary was on YouTube. It's called 1973 Houston Mass Murders. But be careful because they show them digging bodies out.
Yeah.
And the other part that's so insane is they get inmates from the local jail to help them dig it out. And you're like, what if you had gotten a DUI and they were like, come dig out. Chill. Like, you're going to be fucking scarred for life.
Yo, no. And everything about that part where it's like they just got some people who are not qualified basically as a punishment to uncover like a killing boat shed. Like the most
teenage
awful
boys.
Yeah.
Okay. So they begin to dig and find a body within minutes. They find the first body. Okay, so let's go to Dean Coral. There's a ton of shit about his childhood. I don't think any of it's relevant. It's like the typical kind of shitty childhood. Mom and dad divorced, blah, blah, blah. But it's not, I don't think it's that important to the story that I'm telling. So I'm not going to fucking talk about it. He ends up in the Heights neighborhood of Houston. And that's where a lot of this takes place. The Heights neighborhood is kind of this poor, underprivileged neighborhood. And, back then, children ran amok.
Yeah.
You do whatever the fuck you want.
Yeah.
So the reason he got his name, the Candyman, is he worked in his family's candy company. And then in 1965, the candy company moved across the street from an elementary school. And he was known to give free candy to local children.
I mean, it's just, why not dress up like a clown? You've got everything else horrifying going on.
Well, I mean, it's like 1973. They're like, go hang out with that nice man who gives you candy.
It's
absolutely
so suspicious. Yeah.
No, it's so not then, but it should be, right?
Not then. But like now that we know what we know, it's just like people who are like, oh, I'm not trying to catch any fish. I'm just making this huge fishing lure.
Right.
That, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like, what would make children come around all the time?
What's that movie that has, what's his name? Matt Dillon in the kids take over the town.
Oh, on the edge? Over the edge?
Over the edge.
You mean where they're just partying in the suburbs, like, and
yeah,
none of the parents are around?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Watch that movie, and that's what, to me, it seems like this time was like. It's a good movie, but also, you just were out till whenever you wanted to be. You had total freedom.
Yeah.
To hang out with fucking perverted,
yeah, there was
30-year-old men.
Yes, it was the thing of, if they're an adult, they're in charge.
Yeah.
If they're an adult, they're fine.
Yeah.
Like, that's all it takes to qualify, is you have a job and a car, and you don't have, like, long hippie
and
hair.
And you're a good guy.
Then you're good.
You. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was known to give free candy out, in particular teenage boys, and they let, he made a whole rec room for them to hang out in with like a pool table and shit.
Oh.
He's big and broad shoulders, thick black hair and sideburns. He was known, in the words of one of the reporters, a pleasant smiling candy man of the Heights.
Mm-hmm.
Red flag.
Aren't they all?
Aren't they all? Yeah. I don't know. Red flag. yeah. There's a couple pictures of him. There's not a lot. And he just looks like a normal dude. A normal, like, nice looking guy.
Yeah.
Creepy.
Yeah. He's the creepiest in that he.
Clean cut.
Yes. He did it exactly right to not get caught.
He did it so right. Okay. So in 1967, he befriended 12-year-old David Brooks. He was in sixth grade. His family life was kind of falling apart. And so Brooks was taken under Dean's wing as like a mentor almost. Brooks said about him, he was the first adult male who didn't make fun of him and that he was like a father figure, which is insane.
Yeah.
So as a teen, when Brooks became a teen, Coral paid him to allow him to perform fellatio on him. And he began living with Dean a lot since he was from this broken home. And I'm sure his family was like, great, he's got an adult role model.
Yeah.
But according to those who knew Brooks, the teenager wasn't gay. He had a girlfriend who lived in the Heights. But this older man who had known him since he was 12 was like, help me.
Yeah, he basically, well, that's what him. Pedophiles do, yeah. Is they groom, they pick them, they only pick children who aren't being protected.
Yeah, this kid, they say that he was an introspective young kid, so he probably didn't have a ton of friends. His parents were divorced and moved away. So, and all of these fucking documentaries and all of these stories, they call Dean Corll homosexual, and I can't fucking, I don't think that's right. I think he's a pedophile.
He's a pedophile.
And that's not the same thing as being homosexual.
Right.
He even had a girlfriend.
Dean Corll did?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he's a pedophile.
He's a pedophile. Like, that's not homosexual.
Right.
So,
that's also, I think, it could be, too, you're reading things from Texas in, like, the 80s, yeah, maybe, yeah, where there's not, you know, people hadn't caught up all the way to, like, what are we really talking about? Because most pedophiles are straight men.
Yeah.
That's like, governmental statistics.
Well, I still see it, like, copied in articles, you know, the homosexual, like, just, he's a pedophile who liked young boys. So, right. It's not, I don't know. It's just, that's something that irks me. Like, I feel like if I had said that, we'd get an email from someone and be like, that's not, you know,
and rightfully
correcting
so.
It. And I totally agree with that.
Yeah, exactly.
So Dean Corll's first known murder victim is 18-year-old Jeffrey Conan. On September 25th, 1970, he'd been hitchhiking from the University of Texas and was dropped off near Dean's apartment. And they think that Dean offered him a ride and he gagged him with a cloth and strangled him. Mm. After the murder of Jeffrey Conan, David Brooks, so his fucking kid who was 15, walks in on Corll in the act of assaulting two teenage boys who Corll had strapped to a plywood torture board. And Corll promised Brooks a car in return for his silence. He told Brooks, 15 years old, that he is part of a gay pornography ring. He had been paid to send the boys to California to pose for photos. That's what his story was. It's so you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
Somehow. But then later Corll confessed that he had killed the boys, and he offered David $200 for any boy he could lure to Corll's apartment. And at this point, it seems like Brooks, people say he didn't have a choice, you know, right. He was in now part of it because he had not told about the two boys he had seen him molesting.
And also this is a life change that's been introduced by a person he trusted.
Yeah.
So he hasn't had any other adults in his life that have been reliable, it sounds like, or good people. And now the one person that he sees as a good person is introducing all these kind of variables where he's supposed to believe this is okay behavior.
Or it's like, yeah, cut this person who's supported you for the past, you know, few years out of your life, or do what's,
or play along.
Play along. You're not going to kill anyone, just bring him to him. I mean, it's insane. It's an insane fucking story.
But it's kind of like brainwashing. I mean, really, that's, you know, he's getting people, he's not convincing anybody that's like coming from a great background with a lot of solid ground under their feet.
Yeah.
Which isn't in no way to say if you're from a broken home, obviously,
right,
that you would be, but it's more of the, he knew who to pick to groom to basically brainwash into living this
way. I mean, aside from Dean Corll, who's clearly a psychopath, it's insane that he was able to get this kid, David Brooks, to fucking do this for him. And I can't wrap my head around it. I can't imagine a scenario that I'd ever be okay with that, which means it's a scenario that I can't even imagine. It's like something really insane happened that this kid was okay with it.
Right. Or maybe he wasn't okay with it, but what else? He was already in.
Yeah.
Like, he had nowhere else to go.
Definitely. Okay. On December 13th, 1970, so David Brooks lures two 14-year-old kids named James Glass and Danny Yates. He lures them from a religious rally to Corll's apartment. You know, the thing of like, hey, let's go party. You know, I got some weed and we can hang out at this dude's house.
Yeah.
Like, cool older guy. Everyone
loves
it.
There's a pool table.
Do you know who it is? It's fucking, it's the movie. Oh my God, what's wrong
with my Matthew
brain?
McConaughey.
It's from Matthew motherfucking McConaughey.
Yeah.
From
Dazed and Confused.
Dazed and Confused.
Yes.
That's exactly who he is. And the victim is the kid from it with the long hair.
Yeah.
The little kid, the new freshman.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. And like, everyone's like, Matthew McConaughey's character's so cool. No, he's a fucking perverted pedophile.
He's an old man.
He's a gross old man.
Yeah.
He wants to hang out with high school kids.
But there is that thing of inclusion. If you are living your whole life, so say it is, let's use the Dazed and Confused example, and that kid isn't just getting his ass kicked at school, but there is very violent scenes of him getting his ass kicked at home,
totally.
And home being an unsafe place for him to be. And then you've got Matthew McConaughey rolling up and being like, hey man, it's chill, come and play pool.
Yeah, get in my cool car, I'll drive you around town, we'll go to this bar, play pool. Totally. Yeah,
you finally found somewhere to land.
Yeah.
You don't want to give that up right away.
No.
But then it's almost like he slowly ebbed away, or there's a better way to say it, but like, it's almost like I bought you a car, you know, like he's just slowly grinding down this kid's inner identity.
Yeah.
It's fucked up.
I mean, yeah, definitely.
So the police should arrest Matthew McConaughey, is what I'm saying.
Let it make it so much worse. You know, our tagline.
Always.
So both boys, James Glass and Danny Yates, are tied to opposite sides of Coral's torture board and subsequently raped and strangled. Oh. 6 weeks after that double murder on January 30th, 1971, Brooks and Coral find two teenage boys, brothers named Donald and Jerry Waldrop. Walking. The boys were taken into the van, driven Coral's apartment, and it's like they don't grab them off the street. They want a party, which is the scariest part to me.
Yeah.
The apartment where they rape, torture, and strangle the brothers. And at this point, Brooks drops out of school. He's 100% with Coral.
So yeah, and I bet you he's, sorry, but I bet you he's, if there's some, you know, like the moral compass inside, he's probably having to self-medicate so much just to make all of this okay.
Right. And then having a normal life like school and teachers, your brain can't wrap around that.
There's no going back to sitting in a classroom after you're doing shit like this.
Totally. So between March and May of 1971, Coral abducted and killed three more victims, all of who lived in the Heights area as well. His MO in most cases was gruesome torture and rape, and he'd sometimes shoot them, sometimes strangle them. A couple occasions he'd leave his victims to die by bleeding out from the gunshot wound. And in each of these abductions, Brooks is known to have been a participant. Again, they go a lot further into it if you're okay with gruesome shit in last podcast on the left.
Yeah.
The other two victims were 13-year-old David Hildegeist and 16-year-old Greg Winkle, and they were abducted and killed together on the afternoon of May 29th, 1971. And so in the case with other parents as well, both sets of parents are frantic to find their kids. They know something is wrong. These are young boys who don't run away. And one of the people who voluntarily offered to distribute posters of the boys was a friend of theirs, 15-year-old neighbor Wayne Henley, lifelong friend of Hildegeist. So at this point in 71, Brooks introduces Coral to Wayne Henley. Remember him from the beginning of the story. He shot and killed Dean Coral.
Yeah.
And it's possible that Wayne was supposed to be a potential victim, but for some reason they became friends, and Wayne Henley became another accomplice. Wayne Henley said about him, "We hit it off. He was a smart, clean cut, nicely dressed man. He listened to me. He explained things to me. I'll be honest with you. It was important that Dean liked me. He was kind."
Wow.
I know.
Which then explains, is it David Brooks?
Yeah.
Yeah. Explains his participation.
Same thing. Yeah.
The value of just being there and like
not
listening.
Not being parental, being like the cool uncle.
Yeah. Or just trying to like pay attention a little bit.
Yeah.
I feel like parents are getting that now, nowadays, like in spades.
Yeah.
But in the 70s, it was just like, your parents were the people that came home and you ate meals with.
And they yelled at you.
Yeah.
Because it was like, it was also in a lower class neighborhood. So it was probably both parents were working. So they didn't have time to fucking deal with your shit.
And,
you know, and you were, maybe you were a bad kid, let's say, and they didn't. Yeah.
Yeah. You were just one more headache.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it is for some people and was for a lot of people back then.
Yeah, for sure. They hit it off. And when he found out Henley didn't go to the police, even when Coral told him that he had been the person who abducted and killed David Hildegeist, his childhood friend. Coral pushed Henley to bring him another boy, and he picked Frank Aguirre, a good friend of his, which is so fucking insane.
But I think that speaks to the level of psychopath that Dean Corll was, because they're like the greatest, like, traveling salesman that you've ever met. Like, that's what they're like.
Like, that to me is so dark. I mean, it's fucking crazy and awful, obviously, but like, to bring a friend, to know that he's going to get, at least he's going to get raped.
But I mean, I think that the pitch is on Dean Corll's side is like, I will like you even more.
Yeah.
You will get even more for me, even better. Like,
it's, show me you mean it.
Yeah.
Almost like, show me how much you're
maybe
involved in this. Totally.
I mean, whatever psychopaths do to get you to hypnotize you into doing what they want, this guy was good at it.
Yeah. Very good. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
Okay, so they bring him. Okay, they play the game, which we fucking have heard again and again, the handcuff game. The good old handcuff game, the one where Henley and Brooks put on the pair of handcuffs behind their back. They have a secret key, and they're like, see, they're trick handcuffs. You try it. And then he tries it.
Nope.
And he's stuck. Ugh, you can just picture it. It breaks my fucking heart.
If you are ever in a scenario, age, anything up till at any point in your life, let's say there's no age limit on this game, and someone says, let's play the handcuff game, immediately walk out of the room and call the police.
Kick them in the, yeah.
Why else? Because at the very least, they're a magician, so you should call the police anyway. But there's almost nothing good comes out of the handcuff game.
No, don't be alone in a room with a man ever, unless it's your boyfriend or something. Don't be alone in a room with a man. Especially if there's handcuffs.
It's three times underlined if there's handcuffs.
Do you think I'd ever let anyone but like Vince and Steven in this house if I were alone? No, I would. If someone knocked, I would tiptoe to the door. I would peek out the thing and I'd be like, hell fucking no.
Now, what if you had the handcuffs? What if the power was in your hands?
I don't know. I would just like handcuff him and paint his nails because I'm not a psychopath.
The idea that anyone wants to handcuff anybody is
that's
something
not fun.
Bad is about to happen.
That's not a game.
Let's look for our context clues of bad things happening.
Even if they want to do the fucking Chinese finger trap.
Still, that's two fingers you don't have.
Nope that shit and get the fuck out of there.
Goodbye. I hate this birthday party, mom. Goodbye.
And you're leaving your mom alone with him now. What a dick. Kids are such assholes. Okay, so they play the handcuff game. When Aguirre puts on the handcuffs, Corll drags the teenager into the bedroom and, according to Henley, quote, had his fun with him. Yeah. Can I just tell you, I've been studying this one. I was like, I'm going to do it this week, and I had 2 days to do it. And I'm like, no, you're not. This is too much. And so I've been doing it for 3 weeks and having fucking nightmares.
I bet.
Like, I'm really glad to get this fucking over with.
This one and the Toy Box Killer are like, yeah. I stopped listening to the Toy Box Killer on last podcast. And
I can't do that.
There's nothing.
They have recordings of it. The fact that there's recordings of him.
Just no.
Just don't, you guys, if you're sensitive, don't read the Toy Box Killer about
it. It's the worst.
I'll never do it.
It's pure demonic destruction. There's nothing interesting about it.
No.
It's a person who can destroy people and does very slowly. It's horrible.
Yeah. So in late 72, they brought 17-year-old Billy Balk, who used to sell Dean Corll's candy door-to-door, and his 16-year-old friend Johnny DeLone. 14 months later, Corll, Henley, and Brooks grabbed Billy's younger brother, Michael, who was on his way to get a haircut. How fucking sad is that? First kid goes missing, then they grab his little brother, and he goes missing. And the parents know something is wrong. In a lot of the documentaries, they're like, they thought they were runaways, or like they were poor and they didn't care at that point if they were runaways, which from what I've read and what I can tell, it's not true. His parents knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
So they captured and killed a 20-year-old father who had been living in the Heights and was hitchhiking. They snatched Homer Garcia, a boy from Southwest Houston, who was going to driver's ed with fucking Henley.
Oh.
And then two boys who had just moved into an apartment across the street from Henley's house. Then it was 15-year-old Billy Lawrence, and he was forced to write a letter to his father saying, Daddy, I hope you know at the end, he's saying, I'm going to go away for a little while. I got this job. I'll be back in town. And then he wrote at the end, Daddy, I hope you know I love you, your son, Billy. He was kept alive for 3 days on the plywood because Henry later said Coral, quote, really liked him. Next Monster. Was Rusty Branch and, in total, 28 boys from the Houston area disappeared in a 3 fucking year span.
28?
28 boys, aging from 9 to 21. 11 went missing from the same junior high school. That's 11 teenage boys, not teenage, 13, 14-year-old boys, 12-year-old boys from the same junior high school. Red fucking flag, principal, whatever your name is.
Where is anybody doing anything?
Principal Dave. Fucking... call the police. And at least 20 of them had been residents of either the Heights or the adjoining neighborhoods. Many parents of the boys had desperate searches for their kids. Some took out, so there were people who took out a loan to hire a private detective, offered, and remember, these are people who don't have money,
right?
Offered a large reward, called the police constantly. They employed multiple psychics. In the end, police were even aware that anything was amiss. Of course they did the fucking, they're all runaways.
Yeah.
28 boys in 3 years and they're all runaways. So it was the norm, though, in the 70s, especially kids who came from the Heights, who police just wouldn't even look into it. Okay, about the police, I don't want to blame them and dismiss them as being shitty at their jobs, because there was a lot going on at the time, which made it a perfect hunting ground for Coral. Houston's crazy domineering police chief, Herman Short, he believed in an old school way of law enforcement. Houston was exploding in population. There was a fucking ton of money. So there were really rich people there, and that's who they really cared, or he really cared about. They had an understaffed police force. In 1970, they had half the minimum to police the population.
Whoa.
And this is in places where there's a lot of crime going on. And they underpaid the cops. Federal funds were available, but Short refused any federal assistance, calling it a handout.
Oh, no.
No, no, no. It's like the wild fucking West.
Get out of here.
The workload was so crazy that many cops just gave up, and they played a game of who could leave work the earliest. So parents who had lost their sons on one side of the Heights had no idea that there were parents on the other side of the Heights who had also lost sons. So there was, it was just a disorganized, insane,
hopeless
situation. Yeah. The thought of being a parent and not being, I've always thought about that with the runaway thing, where it's like, you know, your kid better than anyone. There's something wrong.
Also just that the idea that they're essentially, what it sounds like is there was almost no police force for them.
Right.
Which is horrifying. Talk about, this is an amazing Fincher. Here's your next movie.
Dude.
Because it's The Candyman, which in and of itself is a huge, horrifying story.
Like the fact the name is like spot on. It's one of those like
classic.
Yeah.
But then on top of that,
and he's clearly so smart.
Yes.
Dean Coral is so smart, and the opportunity, he got lucky. He got lucky that it was that period of time.
And that he was this master manipulator.
Yeah.
But that part, I remember when Marcus was talking about that part in their thing and the details they gave about all those things. It was mind-blowing, where it's like there's always, you know, it's like the same thing happened in the late 70s in LA. In LA in the late 70s, there was 4 serial killers working at one time.
Jesus Christ.
And it was the same thing. If the cops didn't talk, they were all competing with each other. So they wouldn't do cross-county communication. Yeah. They wouldn't do...
Well, they didn't have a lot of ways of... I mean, even if they wanted to, there was no internet. You couldn't call and be like, do you have someone who was strangled? And it's like, there's tons of other things going on.
Yeah.
At the same time,
there's all kinds of stuff, and it's all everything's like, write a letter. Oh yeah. Do you want to find out if something happened in the valley?
Yeah.
Write a letter.
Right. So the one thing that Chief Short did do in an attempt to make sure the crimes didn't happen after they found out about it was order his officers to raid the city's gay bars.
problem solved. Yay.
Good job. Okay. Let's go back to the beginning of the story. 1973, Wayne Henley leads skeptical police to the boat shed that Dean Coral rented. They start to dig with the help of fucking inmates, and they found the first body in a matter of minutes, then 2 more, then another 6 underneath them, stacked up. Henley also led authorities to a location near a wooded area near Sam Rayburn Reservoir, where four bodies were uncovered. The day after Henley's arrest, David Brooks turns himself in to the police. Henley hadn't even mentioned him. He didn't rat him out. I know. And together they led police to a location on the on High Island. It's like a, there's like a scenes of them digging in a, at a beach. It's crazy.
Wow.
But like people camping and there's fucking bodies. So the, they found six more bodies at High Island. And within a week, the remains of 27 young males had been found.
Wow.
A week after the first bodies are found, despite a few thousand missing persons reports having come in from 1968 to 1970s, the authorities, they call off the excavations, despite the fact that even Henley and Brooks told them they knew where other bodies could be located.
They just decided that's enough?
Well, I think they didn't want the death toll to get higher.
Because it looks so bad.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
I think that they were, like, already under so much scrutiny by the media that they stopped.
Can I just say this to people? If you're ever in this situation where you're in charge of something that's going to total shit... Mm-hmm. The only thing you can do at a certain point is let the truth come out.
Yeah.
Because you pretending, like that idea is so, to me, such a like male in his 60s, I'm in charge of this, watch, listen to me, everybody.
It's narcissistic in a way that I can't put myself in those parents' shoes that they might want to find. Like, I don't understand what anyone else is.
He's prioritizing what it looks like for him as opposed to what it feels like for the victims.
He probably can't even begin to comprehend other people's emotions.
Well, and also, but also he's in a situation that he's not trained for. He's never even thought could happen, but the,
and he screwed up from the get go.
Yeah. And, but the, when you're at that point, let it all come out because you have to think of like long-term how it looks and also what your actual job is. Your job is to protect people. You can't now pretend like you protected anybody because that's off the boards entirely.
Yeah.
Why am I talking about this? I'm not giving advice to this fucking sheriff from 40 years ago, but it bums me out because
I know
you watch people make these decisions where it's like, okay, well now I'm just going to scramble to cover my own ass.
It drives me crazy.
Yeah. Where it's like, it's that part's over.
Yeah.
It's over.
The thing, like my therapist will always say when I get these calamity things in my head of everything's going to fall apart, she's like, okay, what can they not take away from you? And it's like, they can't take away Vince. They can't take away my cats. They can't take my family. I'm healthy still. It's like, it's going to suck and you're going to look like a piece of shit, but it's going to be okay in the long run.
Don't add to it.
Don't fucking add to it by lying.
Don't lie.
Don't lie.
Because here's the other thing too. It's that thing where you can lie, obviously. And in the moment, you're going to think that that's a good fix.
And you're out of it. Yeah. You got out of
it. You're tripling down on how bad you look when you tell a lie. Because here's the thing. And this is a recommendation in lying in general as a great, huge liar all my life. You always get caught and it's humiliating and you look 10 times worse than you actually are.
Yeah.
Cause you think there's a side, you think there's a shortcut. You think you can get out of it by just saying something. Please just know there's always someone around who knows the truth and knows you're lying.
And you're doubling down. You're absolutely right. Because then you can't come back and be like, okay, this is what actually happened.
Right.
It's like, but you also lied about it.
Right.
So you're even a bigger piece of shit.
You're just making everything worse. Like the best thing, and this was like training from high stress TV, daily TV production, where it's just come clean immediately and start fixing it.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that was ever solution. You never got in trouble for fucking up as long as you were in the solution.
Yeah.
But when you lie and you go like, oh, someone else told me, well, then you're delaying the fix.
Yeah.
And delaying the fix is really the worst sin of all. Cause lying is just, that's just for your ego.
Yeah.
But you have to fix it.
Yeah. Fuck.
The 70s.
The 70s. Stop lying. The 80s need to go to prison. The 70s need to stop lying. The 90s.
I'm not ready to talk about the 90s.
We'll get there. We'll go there. We can't give you all our advice in one episode or you'll never listen again. Listen, we have a lot more fucking
look
advice. Look and listen to our advice and take it. Anyways.
The 70s.
Right. Okay, so it's time travel. Okay. So Henley and Brooks get life sentences. They're still alive. Go back in this 1973 Houston mass murders video on YouTube. The cameras are rolling while they're excavating bodies and Henley is talking. Henley is telling reporters what happened. He couldn't stop talking. I bet it's pretty incredible. There's a video, there's a part where he calls his mom, "Mama, I killed Dean." There's a part of him on the phone with his mom
as like cameras are recording it. Jesus Christ.
Yep.
Well, also because I bet you those kids were in complete trauma mode. They were like in shock.
Yeah.
For that years.
It's over. I mean, yeah, it's over. It's crazy. Okay. In 2012, a Polaroid of a young boy handcuffed and screaming. I've seen it.
It's no.
Horrifying.
Don't look at those.
I have to.
Don't. I mean.
I have to. It's my fucking psyche.
Okay. But just. Well, don't do that damage to yourself.
I've been nightmaring.
Yeah. Of course you have.
It turns up in some of Henley's possessions. And when presented with the photo, Henley said he didn't recognize the boy, which if it's true, it means there's at least one other victim, a 29th, that's yet to be identified.
Oh, my God.
It's also guessed that there could have been past accomplices who became victims themselves.
That would make sense.
Just as Henley might have as well. And based on his skill and MO of the first killing, it's very doubtful that was actually his first, the kid who was hitchhiking.
Yeah.
And I completely believe it.
Right.
There's no way. A reporter named Barbara Gibson and Dr. Sharon Derrick, a forensic anthropologist with the medical examiner's office in Houston, now are working to identify the three victims that have yet to be named. These women are fucking awesome. And then to end it, I just want to quote Willie Glass, the brother of Jimmy Glass, who was killed, said Dean Corll didn't just kill 27 boys, he killed 27 families. And that's my story.
Wow.
Of the Candyman, Dean Corll.
That's
and now
amazing.
I don't ever want to think about it again.
Yep. Yeah.
Until David Fincher makes the movie.
The Finch.
Oh God.
Yeah.
That movie would be.
That was great. I mean, that's the best case scenario you can do. Of there's some details in that digging part.
Oh, yeah.
That will be with me forever.
Yeah. I mean, there's some genital mutilation that I didn't talk about. There's some fucking torture stuff that I just can't.
And also, you know what it is. If you've seen one thing, if you've accidentally read or seen something that's about this, that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know what it is. You don't need more of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand the thing of like your curiosity gets the best of you, but I stopped doing that a little while ago only because it becomes all the same. And then you're just basically doing specifics of faces or hair colors or whatever, but it's the same horrible scenario.
Yeah. I mean, I just, you know, I do the thing where I keep going back to that Polaroid they found and I look deep into this kid's eyes to see if I can, what I can suss out of it. You know what I mean? And like, he looks like he's in a box. It's a blurry photo and you can see like a, there's a toolbox next to him, and I keep putting myself in his shoes, and I can't do that. Like, it's.
Well, there's
I
no
feel like I have
point.
To.
To what value? To what end?
It's just being empathetic of the stories that I'm.
You can
telling.
Be empathetic and know nothing about it. Yeah. I'm empathetic, and all I did was listen to what you told me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrifying. But that's also, you know, everybody has different experiences with actually looking at the things.
Yeah.
Just don't get confused about what, you know what I mean?
Yeah. What I need to do.
Do what's good for you.
Yeah.
Nightmares aren't good for you.
Yeah.
That's not the point.
Yeah.
Oh, the Candyman.
Hey, bae.
Everyone will suffer under the Candyman.
Georgia, have you ever been blown away by the most simple dish at a restaurant, like perfectly scrambled eggs?
Oh my God, yes, Karen. And then all I want to do is make that dish at home and eat it every day.
Well, you probably could, as long as you have the chef's secret ingredient, Made In cookware.
Made In was created to bring restaurant quality performance kitchenware to home chefs around the world.
For years, they've built their business by supplying restaurants and top chefs with high-end cookware. Some of Tom Colicchio's most treasured dishes at his restaurant Craft are made in Made In.
Whether you're cooking for professional critics or just the critics you live with, your meals will benefit from the quality of Made In products.
Like their carbon steel cookware, it combines the best of both cast iron and stainless steel clad, so it's rugged enough for grills or an open flame. It's the MVP of summer cookouts and cook-ins. What I really love about Made In cookware is that it actually makes something like having a Memorial Day barbecue much more convenient, because you can keep everything on the grill. If you need to throw, say, a pan of garlic up on the top while you're grilling your steaks on the bottom, it's strong enough, durable enough to do that.
If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes have in common. They're all Made In, Made In.
Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from May 18th through May 27th when you visit madeincookware.com.
That's madeincookware.com.
Goodbye.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, mine is, this is actually, it's not firsthand. I guess it's kind of secondhand, but I've wanted to do this one for a while. I just didn't know any details. And when I would look it up, it was always very vague. There wasn't enough story. And then, one of the shows that is on my DVR that comes up every once a month, it's a show called Demons in the City of Angels.
Ooh.
Have you heard of it?
No.
Okay. So that's where, when I did the publicist that got murdered.
Yeah.
It was from that. That's when I first saw that story. Ooh. And I was like, oh, I remember that. Well, this one is the story I wanted to do. And it came up one day where I was like, oh my God. And it's the murder at the Silent Movie Theater. Oh, do you remember this?
Yeah.
Okay. So
this
on
is good.
Demons in the City of Angels, narrated by an incredibly intense man named AJ Benza, who I believe himself was a crime reporter I don't know that much about him, but I think he has a true crime background.
Yeah.
But now he's hosted lots of shows. I've seen him on other things. But now he narrates this show. And it's all crimes that happen in L.A.
I love it. I need to watch it.
It's pretty good. But this one, I was just so happy because it's the detailed versions of this story. Yeah. So it's 1997 Los Angeles. I moved here in 1994. When did you move here?
98.
Mm-hmm. So this was kind of like one of the first big bad. I mean, I moved here the year of the earthquake and OJ and
riots,
all that stuff happened.
Jeez.
Right around the same time as when I moved here. So this was kind of the next big one.
Yeah.
And this, there's a silent movie theater on Fairfax at Melrose, just below Melrose. I think it's like two blocks below. Right now, it's in flux because it was bought by a company called CineFamily that was doing these amazing, their calendar was incredible. I am a member. I know tons of people who are members, and they would show amazing either new movies or, you know, directors, whole weekends of directors films, all this stuff. It was
really a fun, creative
place.
And then
they very recently, I think it was like 3 months ago, I got an email saying all of our plans are suspended right now because these huge sexual harassment, like, accusations came down the pike, and they're like, until we know what's going on, we're not doing anything anymore.
With the heads of CineFamily.
Yeah. The people who are running it. So I don't know details about any of those things. And that's not what my story is about. Mm-hmm. But it's a bummer because this movie theater has had issues since. I mean, like, I'm very interested to know what was there before.
Yeah.
Because it's never not had bad vibes.
Yeah.
It's like something's going on.
Yeah.
Because there's never not some issue. So we'll go to, this is the night, January 17th, 1997. And this is the anniversary of the 6th year of the reopening of the Silent Movie Theater. So, I think before this, the movie theater had been built by Dorothy and John Hampton. They bought an empty lot there on Fairfax.
Wow.
And they built the theater from the ground up. And, so this guy, Larry Austin got a job at the theater when he's 19 years old. He was a local kid. He grew up in the Fairfax district, but he was gay. And in his teens, his father rejected him. His father basically kicked him out of the house. And he, the Hamptons basically took him in like family. So wow. He started working at the silent movie theater in its original form when he was 19
How
years
cool
old.
How cool would that be?
Yeah. And he was super into, as many people, when you live in Los Angeles, there are a lot of people, it's all about kind of who you know and how connected you are to the movie business or TV, but movies are a little fancier. And this, I think Larry always wanted to be in show business in some way. And working at the silent movie theater, he was, you know, he did everything for this family from when he was 19. He was with the Hamptons for 37 years.
Holy shit.
So he really was like a son of theirs until the theater closed in 1979. And it was basically, it was just kind of a place where people who cared about film and, you know, movie buffs and stuff would go to watch silent films.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like doing, you know, a great business or whatever. So they ended up having to close. And then in May of 1990, John Hampton died. And after he died, Dorothy Hampton was really depressed, and Larry Austin convinced her to reopen the theater. Mm. He thought that would be the perfect thing for her, and she agreed. And so they decide that they're going to go in. The theater was basically kind of left just standing for 10 years with nothing going on in it. So they have to hire a contractor to come in and basically help them rebuild the theater so they can reopen it. And the contractor is a guy named James Van Sickle. As they work on the theater and slowly rebuild it, Larry Austin, who at this point is, I think he is in his early 60s, and Van Sickle, who is in his late 30s, start having an affair.
The contractor and the guy who was family, basically like a son.
Yes.
Got it.
Exactly.
Okay.
The guy whose idea was to reopen and with the widow, Dorothy Hampton. And so they basically put all of their work, and Larry lives in the apartment above the movie theater.
Cool. I didn't even know there was one.
I know.
How awesome.
Don't you love that idea?
Yes.
Like when you go into the theater, the popcorn stand is on the right. There's a set of stairs that's over there too.
Right.
And I think that goes up to the projection booth, I like to picture that also then, like, you walk past the projection booth, then there's
to
like
your bed,
a little gingham, a cot and a kitchen table.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
But I don't really know because I haven't been up there. But that's what that's how it is in my mind. Okay. So basically on the night of the reopening, I'm sorry. So 6 years after the reopening. So they reopen it. Everything goes great. Dorothy is thrilled. And basically they're back in business.
Yay.
And, but eventually Dorothy has to get moved into an old folks home anyway. So on the sixth anniversary of the reopening of the silent movie theater, Larry decides he's going to play the first movie that played there when it originally opened, which is the movie Sunrise. But there's also a bunch of short films that he's playing, and it's kind of just like a big, you know, celebration of the silent movie theater. So this is January 17th, 1997, if I haven't already said that 17 times. Okay. So that night there's like 60 people in the theater. Which is packed for that. If you picture 60 people, that's like fucking wall to wall.
Yeah.
Half an hour into the program. And also Larry, when they reopened it, and I don't know if he did this before, but he definitely did it on the reopening in 1990. He used to go up and introduce every night, every movie, everything in a tuxedo.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah. So this was like his life. And people, really famous people used to go to that theater to watch movies. It was kind of like, you know, it was like a very hipster thing of like, I'm into movies. I'm into fucking silent movies.
I know the owner. He's so cool. Whatever, whatever.
Exactly. So Larry goes up and he's like, tonight it's a Buster Keaton feature, whatever. And he like, basically, if you don't know that much about silent film, you were still introduced and kind of brought into that world in this really lovely way. And he
made them special.
Yeah.
You're not just going to see a movie. It's a production.
Yes. And it's like old Hollywood. Yeah. And that was
the tuxedo is like the crowning glory.
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
He's like a nightly, he had a job where he got to wear a tuxedo every night.
Totally.
He was into it. And just so you know, after they redid the whole theater, Larry Austin kept James Van Sickle on as his projectionist. So Van Sickle was interested in films, I think, yeah. or at least knew enough to become the projectionist. But basically, this relationship grew up out of them rebuilding the silent movie theater. And Larry Austin's friends said he was over the moon. I mean, he fucking gets this hot, young, beefy contractor.
Man.
And they're working on the love of his life, this project, you know, that he's worked on all of his life. They said he was so thrilled. There's a friend of his is in the, Demons in the City of Angels, where he just says, like, he would look at him, like, when he talked, like, he hung the moon. I mean, he was just completely in love. And they lived in the little apartment together over the movie theater.
And that's the end, right? And they lived happily ever after.
And that's all I have to tell you about today.
They adopted two children from an
Wait, really quick.
Yeah.
Something terrible happens. So on the night of the 6-year anniversary. It's like me with the story. Don't tell me about the crime scene photos. On the night of the 6-year anniversary, Larry goes up. Tonight we're gonna watch Sunrise and then all these other short films and da da da. He goes back out into the lobby, into the ticket booth. And about half an hour into the program, a guy gets up and comes out and says he wants to buy tickets for a future showing. There's a girl named Mary Giles. I think her last name is pronounced Giles or Giles. And she's 19 years old. She works at the concession stand. And she's like, oh, you need to talk to Larry about buying future tickets. And when the door opens to that ticket booth that's in the front of the theater, the guy pulls a gun, a 357 Magnum, out of his pocket and tells Larry he wants all the money from the ticket booth. So Larry gives him all the money. He pulls everything out of the cash register and gives it to him and comes out of the booth. And with Mary, he hands the money over and the guy with the gun takes the money, drops it, and shoots Larry in the face.
In the face.
In the fucking face. He shot him. Once in the face, Larry goes down and then he turns and shoots him like, I think, 3 more times.
Oh my God.
Just like to make sure he's dead.
No.
Then he turns to Mary Giles and shoots her twice in the chest.
She's just a fucking girl working at the.
She's just a girl working at the movie theater.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
The way I pictured it in my head all the time is like so much different than it actually.
That it happened in the theater?
Well, because also. And I didn't know this until the first time I went to the silent movie theater. It's fucking tiny.
Yes.
It's not like, you know, your fucking IMAX theater. It's a tiny little space.
Yeah.
A tiny office in the front.
Yeah.
So this is all close quarters.
Yes. It's very close quarters. Like it feels almost New York style close quarters.
It's a mini like art house movie theater.
Yeah. And when you're there, like, that's where I went to go see Zodiac.
Right.
When they redid it. And it was perfect because you could see it perfectly. There was no bad seats and the place was packed. So it was like everyone was excited to see that movie.
It's like a small town movie theater, it reminds me of.
Exactly.
Which is like one screen. That's it.
Yeah.
Anyways, shoots Mary.
He fucking shoots Mary also.
Oh, honey.
And then runs out through the movie theater. So he has a front door. He can run out and be right on Fairfax.
Why didn't he do that?
He ran through the movie theater, shot into the air while these people are watching the movie, and then runs out the back door where the patio is.
Oh my God.
So everyone in the theater witnesses this guy with his hood pulled up, shooting into the air. Of course, everyone freaks out and runs. So, you know, the police come, Mary gets taken to the hospital, and she survives.
Oh, good.
Two to the fucking chest, and Mary survives.
Two to the chest?
Two to the chest. Yes.
Girl.
Okay. So,
everyone interviewed in the episode?
No.
Okay.
Everyone was so freaked out by this. I completely remember it happening. I remember everybody talking about it. And at the time, we had just started doing stand-up comedy shows at Largo, which is five blocks down the street.
That's so scary.
Yes. So, the guy that owns Largo, which is now at a different, much larger location, is a guy named Mark Flanagan. He's the owner operator and he's one of those, he's an Irishman from Belfast. He's full of shit. His eyes are dark brown. He's full of shit. And he is one of my favorite people on the planet. Yeah. He's one of my closest friends. Oh, and he's the kind of person that starts to talk to you when you very first meet him, like you've already been talking for 20 minutes.
I love it.
It's my favorite. It's the kind of person that's just like, anyway.
Yeah.
And he, is one of the first stories he ever told me.
What?
Because after the shooting, they had just opened Largo at that location, which is now, I think it's a bar called The Dime.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that.
You're probably right.
It's, and now it's a very hipster area.
It doesn't look the same at all. They like gutted it.
Oh, really? They redid the whole thing?
I think.
Oh, I haven't been in there.
I could make that up.
But they had just opened Largo and they were just starting to get like the music acts every night and stuff. And, James Van Sickle came down and told Flanagan what happened. Like Larry got shot. He was murdered. Mm. We don't know what's happening. The police are investigating it.
The carpenter was telling him this.
What's that?
The carpenter was telling
the contractor, Flanagan. Exactly. This? Yeah. This Flanagan telling the story of the guy coming down.
I don't
and
know
saying,
why I made him a carpenter, but.
Well, that's what a contractor is.
Okay.
He can just do more than carpentry.
Right.
So he basically comes down and says, we want to have a memorial fundraiser. Is there anything you can do to help? And Flanagan's like, well, you can have it here. So they have a memorial fundraiser for Larry Austin and for the Silent Movie Theater at Largo.
Oh, my God.
In March of 1997.
Were you there?
No. This was before...
Just say yes.
But remember the lies? They get found out.
Right.
Because then the seven people from Largo are like, I was there, you weren't there.
You absolutely weren't there.
But he was like, well, of course, these are our neighbors and we want to be good people and we just opened this business. Sure. Like, we want to play ball, whatever. It was Flanagan and John Bryan, the famed musician who also was kind of like, had... I don't think he was an owner, but he was like, you know, this was his home club. And he of course wanted to help in any way. So I think part of the benefit was John played and they got other musicians to play and they raised a bunch of money and gave it to the Silent Movie Theater, in, you know, Larry Austin's name.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out the same night that they have this, which was, March 12th of 1997, is the same night that the police begin to surveil James Van Sickle because he is the prime suspect in this murder. But he doesn't know it and nobody else knows it either. But as they were looking into after this crime and they start looking into who's involved in this, James Van Sickle is the one person named on Larry Austin's will of who the now what also nobody knew was the movie theater, the land and all of the films inside the whole thing was worth over $1 million.
I bet that land, man, if you own that land.
Oh yeah.
In LA,
right on Fairfax.
Yeah.
So
holy shit.
They start looking into James Van Sickle's past and his, like, basically his record. And they find out, he, in 1988, was charged with attempted murder in a Compton, case, but it was dismissed after the victim failed to appear in court. So that just went away.
That goes away if the victim.
In 1989, he was sentenced to 4 years in Orange County for selling drugs, transporting and selling narcotics. He served half that time at Chino. And he also had check fraud charges that were pending. Mm-hmm. So I guess they were still working on that. He had several aliases. He had multiple California driver's licenses.
Wow. Fraudster.
Yeah. And in 1996, so the year before, mm-hmm. Larry Austin had filed a police report accusing Van Sickle of assault and battery. Assault and robbery.
Wow.
But he ended up dropping the charges. So clearly, this relationship was not as lovey-dovey as everyone thought.
Yeah, guilty.
Yeah. And there was some serious shit going on. Detective John Miller, who worked on the case, said that they then came to understand that they actually had a very on again, off again relationship. And that was stormy. And that sometimes Van Sickle went and lived in Carson, when he was not living with Larry. Mm. So it wasn't full time, like everybody kind of thought.
Can we stop having on again, off again relationships, people?
Just off again,
just off it.
If that's what you're going through.
Off the relationship. Okay, well, Vince and I offed again once. And then on again and again.
Everybody does.
Once. You're allowed one time.
Sure.
Otherwise, your friends are so sick of you talking about it.
If it's on again, off again, it just is. Everybody is knows it's a dead in the water situation.
You're just like, you're needy.
You just can't let it go. Okay.
Advice from Karen and Georgia.
So there's so much.
Don't listen.
But as they're looking into it, they also find that Larry Austin has a bit of a murky past himself. In 1983, he was convicted of one count of grand theft as a result of an embezzlement case at a company that he worked for. And he actually served 22 months in state prison.
Wow.
And then also, they start to look into his ownership of the theater because Dorothy Hampton, who owned it, the widow John Hampton, it being in the convalescent home, they didn't track any money going to her from the theater, even though she was the original owner. So, they were afraid that it looked like he had Dorothy Hampton's blessing in this reopening and basically in the ownership of it, but, they didn't have any, proof. She hadn't signed anything over to him that they could prove. So they end up freezing the IRS and the LAPD end up freezing Larry Austin's assets and, putting the theater in a conservatorship until they can figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. Because it's not even like, oh, he was killed for the theater, because it might not have even been his to give to anybody.
Definitely.
So it turns out, there's a break in the case. What they put a sketch in the newspaper of the guy that held up the place, and somebody sees that and comes forward to the police and tells the whole story, which is Van Sickle hired this guy who ended up doing the murder. And his name was, it turns out his name was Christian Rodriguez. He was also 19 years old.
Shit.
And Van Sickle hired him, promised to pay him $25,000 to kill Larry Austin.
Jesus.
And make it look like a robbery.
Yeah.
And that's why he also shot Mary Giles.
Right.
Because it was like, oh, what would a robber do in this case?
So he just fucking took another person out for free.
Van Sickle said he was going to pay him an extra $5,000 to kill to make it look like a robbery and kill anyone else that was there.
Oh, that's horrible. I'm so glad Mary survived.
Yeah. It's insane. It's
so insane.
It's so fucking crazy.
It's so heartless.
Well, and what it was he found out he was named in Larry Austin's will as being the person that was going to inherit everything. So he would have, but he apparently was in such debt and in such financial straits. He wasn't going to, Larry Austin was 74 years old at this time.
Yeah.
And he couldn't even wait to inherit.
Yeah.
He's like, I want all of it now.
Dude.
He was the projectionist the night of the murder. He was there. He came downstairs.
Nuh-uh.
He was the one that hit the alarm that got the police there when he went downstairs and found Larry's body.
That is such a creepy detail.
Yes. So he was there pretending to be all upset and freaked out. He told all the friends the stories, and all the friends were like, we thought he was like completely traumatized and that this was just as much of a thing against him.
Perfect that he was there, you know, like, it just seems like he's less, if he wasn't there, it'd be like, where was he? But
okay. Yeah.
Anyways,
it's kind of more proof that he was like right there making sure it all went
out. Totally.
So essentially he didn't pay afterwards. He didn't pay Christian the money.
Don't do that.
Yeah. And so that's why that guy, whoever the anonymous person was that came forward, was basically someone who knew Christian Rodriguez and was like, he was supposed to pay this money. He didn't do it. Like, you know,
sure.
So when they go find Christian Rodriguez, of course, Rodriguez completely turns on James Van Sickle. So in April of 1999, Christian Rodriguez is found guilty of murder and sentenced to life without parole. And he was also convicted of the attempted murder of Mary Giles.
Good.
And Van Sickle was also sentenced to life without parole.
Wow.
Neither of them got the death penalty. And Mary Giles survived and testified against Christian Rodriguez in court. She's like, that's the man that shot me two times in the chest.
Jesus.
Insanely enough.
She's a fucking badass.
Insane. So when all that happens, like the cops come to Flanagan and they ended up, the cops talked to them. We're like, are you in on it?
With no.
Them? Because
your friend Flanagan.
Yes. The cops came almost immediately after the fundraiser because they're like, how come you're giving money to this guy?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, we're trying to be good neighbors. They're immediately like looped in on it and have to basically go like, yeah, we don't know him. We just thought we'd be nice.
Yeah. It does look like they're like, yeah, let's throw a fundraiser. It does look
like. Let's get more money for you or whatever.
Kind of in on it.
I mean, they had to prove they weren't. Yeah. They had nothing to do with it and didn't really know the guy. Which is one of my favorite, like when Flanagan told me that story, I was crying laughing because he's like, we're like basically faking it and trying to be nice and like, sure, of course we care.
Yeah.
And then immediately they're just like,
they're like, we just started this business.
Yeah.
And now we're under investigation for murder.
Yeah. Now we're in on it.
I love it.
One of the saddest things and the like final thing that I put at the end of this, is, in his court file, there was a forgery charge that James Van Sickle had that they had a letter from Larry Austin attached to it that was attesting to James Van Sickle's good character.
Aww.
Trying to get him out of the forgery charge.
Because he loved him.
Because he really did love him.
That's so sad.
It's very sad.
I want to see photos of them. I'll look it up.
Yeah, you can.
Me and my photos, man.
You sure do.
Just you love use my photo. Fucking imagination.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's that.
That's amazing because everyone knows that murder. It reminds me of the Zanku chicken murder where it's like, there's this like iconic place in LA and it's like, here's this fucking insane story behind it.
Yes. And there are people like, there was a guy that was trying to make a documentary about Larry Austin because of, it was that kind of those early days of like, back when, you know, Larry Austin would be like, everyone would know who he is and he'd have a website these days. But back then it was like, you had to be, that was back in the, you know, I like them first days where everything was word of mouth.
Yeah.
If you like something cool, it's because a cool person told you about
it. Secret underground thing.
Yeah.
That you had to stumble upon and know about, like comic book shops and all these record stores and
So there's this guy that was, and this is in the episode of Demons in the City of Angels, there's a guy that was trying to make a documentary about Larry Austin for years, and he was a big fan of the Silent Movie Theater and he used to go there.
This is before he got killed?
This is before.
Wow.
And he would be like, I just want to like follow you around and whatever. So this guy was there to attest because he had started this documentary and he was kind of there. He knew all the players. He like knew everything that was going on.
That's crazy.
Yes. Yeah.
And did he ever finish it? Because what a fucking crazy finish to it.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, yeah. Because now the finish is, oh, that guy got murdered.
Yeah.
So I don't think. I don't think so.
Probably not. Yeah. That's not what he wanted. That's not the direction he wanted to go.
I don't think so. I mean, it's so horrifying. Yeah. But I mean, also, if he did, that would be kind of crazy. Could be like, guess what happened? Because to me, the creepiest time is after someone gets murdered. And before anybody finds out who did it, there's all these people who are pretending. And it's like this guy, James Van Sickle, had to pretend to be the heartbroken, shocked, traumatized boyfriend for months. Like basically up until for months.
Who can do that?
Yeah.
Those people are scary.
Yeah. Well, if you don't have a conscience, then it's easy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, shit, that was great.
Thanks.
Thank you for sharing. Thank you for sharing, Karen.
Thank you for listening.
Mm,
yeah.
My pleasure. Happy things this week.
Oh, yes.
What you got?
This is super dumb, but I think it's a small, like, there's so many things I want to fix my house.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are very large. And so I do that thing where if I have a bunch of things to do, I don't do anything because it all becomes very overwhelming.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So you're just like, So
don't do any of it.
Don't do anything because, oh, it's so hopeless and blah, blah, blah.
And how do you pick one thing? Yeah.
Oh my God. Right. Because I'm like, oh, I need to repaint my house. I need to fix. There's tons of stuff that I need a contractor for.
Mm. Oh, my God. Don't do it.
But instead, I was getting other shit at Target. This is not a commercial. But I found a lamp at Target. like just a standing lamp to go in, into my front room where there's never good light. You have to be careful of light in your house and in your surroundings.
This is freaking me out. Go on.
Okay. Did we get the same lamp?
A, my thing that made me happy this week was going to Target at 8 a.m. this morning.
No!
B, in my car is a standing lamp.
No. Is it brass colored?
Yes! Does it have a clear shade?
We got the same lamp.
A clear shade?
No.
See-through glass shade?
No, I saw that one though. I got the one that looks basically like a desk lamp.
What the fuck?
Yes.
How did we...
Okay, because, well, here's
our
the thing.
Our periods are synced and our targets are synced and our lamps are synced now.
Yes. This is our new life.
This is our life.
Hi.
You're my husband.
Hi. My wife. I was just going to say that little change of just trying to make it look slightly nicer in the room I'm mostly in.
Yeah.
It puts me in a great mood. And because I did that, when I got home from Toronto, I looked at the pile of mail on my counter, which is just, I assume it's supposed to be there. And it just like, it gets kind of high. And then I go like this and it gets really high again.
God, yeah.
I got rid of all of it.
Girl, I need to do that.
Yep. And that's how I found that check. Remember when I texted you? I'm like, hey, I should rip this up, right? But I want to double check that because it was like laying that's on so top funny. Of that pile.
What the fuck, man?
Clear your piles. Guys, clear your piles and get like one new thing that's going to make you feel good.
Light. You see this place at night. It's so dim and it depresses the shit out of me.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Ooh, let's get that lamp up here.
Yes. Help me carry it. Steven, go grab that lamp.
So wait, so I just stole yours because that was going to be yours?
No, you know what my happy thing is? That we just did that.
Yay.
That we just did that.
Samesers.
That our period sank this week. I know that's gross, everyone, TMI, but I got so excited. And had to text you. Is that gross?
I wrote back, I'm so sorry. And then she wrote back, the ultimate sign of friendship.
Yeah,
and I was like, I mean, yay.
That all that means is like, we're spending quality time together.
So much time.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, nice. I love it.
That's great.
Now I want to set that lamp up right this second.
Oh, my God.
Also, don't be afraid to buy like a 30-watt light bulb.
Yeah.
Because everything's 60 and it's
never
too bright.
Okay, got it. Like look how many. I have 18 vintage lamps in here and they're all dim.
Yeah. But well, also because you've got
cute.
The shades but look dark how, in it.
They're like those huge shades that your grandma had.
Yeah. That's what I have too.
Cool.
We've done it.
We did it.
We've
done it again.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you guys for listening. You're all fucking angel babies.
We couldn't do it without you. We're only doing it for you.
Yeah. There's nothing without you. This is all for you.
We're nothing without you.
Yeah.
It's all for you. And stay sexy.
And don't get murdered.
Bye.
Bye. Elvis. Hold on. Give him a second. Elvis. A cookie? Here he comes.
There he is.
Look, all sleeping. I'll
What okay, you ready? Doing, sleepy?
Elvis, want a cookie? want a cookie?
I like the first quiet one.